Welcome back to Lost in Citations. Today's guest is Fred E. Anderson, Professor Emeritus at Kansai University. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for coming on Lost in Citations.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me.
It's a thrill for me, for people that have been listening to the podcast for a while. You're used to hearing my colleague Chris Haswell's lovely British tones. And if you listen to our December show, I was telling everyone that I've kind of cut back on the interviews because I've been working on my PhD, and I'm only going to be interviewing people from now until I finish the PhD who fall into my specific research interests. And the guest today is heavily in my sights, and it's a real thrill to be able to talk to you because you wrote an influential chapter in 1993. In the first handbook, Teaching English at Japanese Universities, and you revisited the topic in the 2019, a new handbook, Teaching English at Japanese Universities. And in corresponding to you, you also recommended to me a chapter that you did focusing on a topic within these chapters about the interactional umbrella, which we might discuss later. So thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. It is a great thrill to read someone's work who you respect and then be able to talk to them face to face via this internet.
Okay, thank you again.
All right. So what I'd like to do, I'd like to kind of set the context of people's research, how it aligns with their own personal story. And this is a really fun way to do it because it's almost a time capsule. It was funny as you were sort of looking back on the 1993 chapter and the 2019 chapter. You were kind of reflecting. You were saying, well, this is what I was doing in my life in 1993, and I was, doing my dissertation, and then you kind of just dropped the thing. Well, I'm a grandfather now, and I'm going towards the end of my career. So what was that like for you to kind of think about a chapter you wrote in 1993 and kind of re revisiting it over 25 years later?
It was an interesting exercise. It was a little bit different than anything else I had done, but in a good way. Because when I had first been asked by Paul Wadden, he first suggested that we actually just reprint the same chapter and, annotate it in some way or another, update it a little bit. But I thought, no, I don't really want to do the same thing if I'm going to do the same thing. If I'm going to take up this topic again, I would like to update it in my own way and kind of embed the previous chapter in the new chapter, which is how that came about.
Embed maybe is the right word because a lot of the core pillars haven't really changed.
Right. So that was one of the things I wanted to bring out. Put it in a sense, I think the night that the more recent chapter was both more personal and more academic, trying to embed it in my own life more, and at the same time refer to more updated and academic references that I had become familiar with, more familiar with since the original article.
All right, well, let's go back. I'd like to kind of get your history. So, how did you end up coming to Japan? Let's start with that.
Okay, well, as many people in my era, I graduated from college in 1975, University of Oregon, with a degree in mathematics and a sort of minor in French. And I had really no idea what I wanted to do with it. So I was kind of doing odd jobs for a few years in temps and things like that. And finally, I answered an ad for a job in Sapporo, Japan, teaching at a language school. And I had been interested in languages, and I knew people who had gone to Japan, and I thought, okay, that sounds like a good option. So I was hired in 1977, worked at the same school until 1979, and I had no particular intention to be a language teacher or a linguist permanently, although I did have a long-standing interest in languages, and I was learning, Japanese as I went along. And just kind of by being in the right place at the right time, I got a university position in Hakodate from 1980 to 1984. And I like to tell people that I was really totally unqualified for it by current standards. I had a bachelor's degree, 2 years of teaching at an Eikaiwa school, but I looked the part, okay? I was a young, blonde, fairly tall American who looked like I could have been somebody in an English textbook. And this was at a really low-level university. I mean, a university which was almost non-competitive. And I think that, a big part of the hiring, it was just being in the right place at the right time and knowing a little bit of Japanese and fitting the profile of what they were looking for.
You kind of highlighted it in, I think, the 2019 chapter that, up until like the early 90s, it was kind of the heyday for, or maybe you didn't, and maybe I was reading another paper that had referenced your chapter, but they were kind of talking about that the 80s, up until the early 90s was kind of like a good time to teach in Japan, as far as like
Yes.
the money was higher. Maybe there was less foreigners here. I don't know. I don't, maybe you could speak to that, but I heard that that was kind of the heyday.
There are far fewer foreigners. So I mean, I was in Sapporo, and there were late 70s, and there were, I don't think there were more than a couple hundred Westerners, and pretty much we were all Eikaiwa teachers or missionaries, or a few people were university teachers. And they tended to have more qualifications, but not necessarily PhDs. Pretty much, if it was an English teaching job at a university, you could often walk into a good job at a university with a master's degree and very minimal experience.
Now, your story is a little bit similar to mine, besides the fact that you were able to land that college job soon. So I came to Japan in 2007, and I stayed for about a year and a half working at an Eikaiwa. Then I met my wife, and we moved to Australia for about 5 years, and then came back. Then after I came back, I worked on my master's, and then ended up getting a position. Now I'm working on my PhD, but I think what's kind of interesting is that you went from the Eikaiwa job to the university job. What you're sounding is like sort of a low-ranked university. Did you notice, because I definitely did, going from the Eikaiwa to a university that isn't as highly ranked with compulsory English education, lower motivation, that's when I really saw the silence thing. Like, because like people that went to the Eikaiwa, I think they had like a clear goal. Like they wanted to study overseas, or they wanted to improve their language ability for personal reasons or whatever. But I noticed silence a little bit in that Eikaiwa, but it was kind of like a vibrant environment. Maybe people have different experiences. The silence really struck me when I got into the classroom at university. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. But I would say in the case of the university where I was, it was silence on the one hand in terms of non-responsiveness, but on the other hand, very noisy. Students, I mean, sometimes they'd be silent and sleep. Sometimes they would be looking out the window. Sometimes they would be just chatting away with their classmates. And part of it was, just because it was not, they were required English classes. They were not places where most of the students were actually interested in learning English. It was mostly boys. They were mostly there to play sports and just to get out and get a degree and get a job. And I kind of felt sorry for the ones that really did want to learn, because there wasn't a very good infrastructure for that. But then on the other hand, too, I was young. Okay, I was not much older than the students, and so it's more difficult to, get the kind of respect from students if you're that young and you're not really sure if you know what you're doing yourself and you're not used to the system.
So I know in the 1993 chapter, you were really deep in your PhD at that point, or at least you had like started it.
Right.
So did you get a master's before that?
Well, yeah, okay. I'll just go back another step too. Actually, between my Sapporo job and Hakodate job, I had about 6 months or a year actually. I traveled a little bit and then I went back to the States, to Oregon for 6 months. And when I was in Oregon, I actually was able to teach English to refugees at a community college.
Oh, wow.
Again, without a master's degree. So, I mean, just based on a little bit of experience. And then from 1984 spring, excuse me, from 1980 spring until 1984 summer, I was at Hakodate University. And I got married in the interim. And then I got a grant, a doctoral or a graduate's fellowship grant from the East West Center in Hawaii from 1984. And so then I went back full time from 1984 to pursue my master's studies and continued into the PhD program. But then our oldest son was born while we were in Hawaii, and the grant wasn't really enough to cover more than basic expenses, so we were going broke. Make a long story short, I took a job in Fukuoka at Fukuoka University of Education starting from 1987, by which time I had completed my coursework for the PhD, but was not yet working on the dissertation. And then while I was in Fukuoka, I started working on my dissertation, which was a study of classroom interaction in Japanese elementary school in an ethnographic study mainly of one classroom.
Was this the school that your children were going to?
No, it wasn't actually.
Okay.
By that, I mean my children. When we went there, we had one son. My other son was born a few years later, and so they were too young to go to it yet, but it
Okay.
was kind of in the neighborhood where we were living. And it I had gotten in, been able to do long-term observations through a connection at my university,
Okay.
which I think
Well,
is much more difficult now than it was then.
okay. Well, as we were talking before we started the show, I'm also living in Fukuoka. I love Fukuoka. And it's odd too because I have this strange connection to Kansai University. I wonder, no, not to skip ahead, but well, I guess we did skip ahead in the introductions. You're a professor emeritus at Kansai University. I do wonder sometimes if I'm going to end up at Kansai University. Curtis Kelly, who you know,
Right.
I've interviewed him twice.
Yeah.
Simon Humphries, I don't know if he was there at the same time you were
I
there.
know Simon, yeah, and in fact, we have a mutual acquaintance in New Zealand who we both published
Okay.
books with, and so I actually knew of Simon before he came.
I've also interviewed Todd Allen, who
Todd,
is,
yes.
and my colleague Chris Haswell's interviewed Chris Raimondo.
Oh, I know all those people.
So,
Todd Allen, I think one of his doctoral professors is a good friend of mine.
I don't know. It'd be funny if after I finish my PhD, if I love Fukuoka though. So it's strange for the problem is there aren't that many universities in Fukuoka, and there's kind of this. It's harder and harder to get tenured positions, as I'm sure you know, and there's this kind of carousel, right? And you gotta, you have a certain amount of years in your contract. You say, okay, do I jump ship early? But then you're on the clock at the next place. And then I don't know. I have this strange Kansai University just keeps a, well, I guess we'll get to it how you got there. But all right, so you're in Fukuoka, you're starting to work on your PhD. I think this PhD topic is fascinating. So you're observing classroom interactions in an elementary school. Did you have the idea that, like, okay, I wanna sort of figure out what's going on at the university level by retracing the steps all the way back there. Is that kind of what you were thinking
That
or
was
something
yes,
else?
that was a part of it. That was a big part of it. The other part of it was that in Hawaii, I even though language in my degree in linguistics, okay, we had to have three specializations. And at the MA level, I did, just kind of all the theoretical stuff, syntax, phonology, historical linguistics. But at the doctoral level, I was doing more applied things, and I focused in three areas: ethnolinguistics, Japanese linguistics, and language learning and teaching. So I never felt like I was really a hardcore thesis person, even though that's, the field that I've been most associated with in one way or another for most of my career. My interest in a lot of my interest in classroom interaction among people from different cultures came from ethnographic studies done in the United States or in other cultures, looking at communication problems between one group and another, not necessarily having anything to do with Japanese. And so that kind of led me into some of the questions that I had, again, reflecting on my background as an English teacher in Japanese universities and, the problems and complaints that non-Japanese teachers usually have if they're not aware of the sociocultural background that students bring with them to the classroom. And then I was able to get access to a class that I could observe over the long term. And that's sort of how my topic evolved.
It's interesting because I think I told you before we started recording that parents can come and observe the classroom. And I've done this many times, and reading your chapter, it really kind of solidified kind of what's going on. But I think the thing that I missed about the classroom, and I think you described it well. There is a bit of chaos, right? It's going on sometimes, right?
That's the first thing I noticed is
It isn't so serious, right? Like there
no.
are core things that are being established, which you highlight, which we can talk about. But there it does seem like people are standing up, talking. That's the first thing. Like then I learn more in your chapter. Okay, now this is kind of like a ritualized speech. But people are standing up and talking, there's group work going on. It's not as like the core themes that are ended up, that you talk about, socializing someone for society later on in life. I can understand those after reading the chapter. But it didn't strike me as like what it is in the literature of what the classic idea of like Japanese reticence or the classic idea of hierarchy. It wasn't like that, right? So even though there are these core themes that do end up making students more silent when they get to university. Does that make sense?
Exactly. And so, I mean, that my first impression when I started observing first grade and second grade classrooms was, this is really chaotic. How can you study anything within this chaos? Which is a kind of typical question that ethnographers in anthropology or any other field, linguistic anthropology or whatever, have when they go into the field and try to figure out how the system is organized rather than trying to impose their own image of what they think it should be organized like.
All right, so let's talk about some of the core things that you pointed out as far as the classroom structure. So number one, you got the aisatsu, that's the formal opening,
That's
right?
right.
Then the class will also end
With an
with
aisatsu.
an
That's
aisatsu.
right.
Okay, so that bookends the aisatsu, okay?
Yes. Okay. So that's a bookending of the classroom. Okay.
Right.
And then within the class individual lessons, you would have what I call the IPRE sequence.
Okay, so then you have the hapyo, where a student will stand up, give a sort of formalized answer, Then you talk about the consensus check between the class, where they say, I agree, or I have something to add. Okay. And then after that, you talked about the small group study where students would get together like during the class at some point. And also you talked about like a class meeting where teacher had minimal involvement, right? Teacher would like leave the room.
Remember if she left the room or not. I did not study those routines in or those activities in detail in my
Okay.
dissertation. I think I just kind of mentioned it in passing
Right.
in the handbook article.
I think my students sometimes are kind of surprised that I don't do a formal close to a lesson. So I'm kind of like, okay, thanks. And then I have to teach them that thanks means I'm finished. Right. So the Japanese students are kind of waiting for like a formal end to a class, right? Okay, we're all finished. Now we'll do this formalized ending ceremony to this, whatever this event is. Where I think I'm much more comfortable. So, okay, it's all. Does anyone have any questions? Okay, thank you. See you next time, right? And there's always this pause. Like, is it really over? Like, I didn't do a formalized aisatsu to end the class. I think Western teachers kind of do an aisatsu to begin the class. Like, we're used to introducing something, right? But I don't think foreign English teachers really do a formalized end to a class that I know of.
No, I agree with that. Now, I'm not sure about university teachers if Japanese do it at the university or not, but at the lower levels of schooling, it's certainly an important thing. And one interesting thing that kind of extension of this, that one of my doctoral students who studied, one of the things he studied was classroom interaction in Japanese junior high school English classes. And he noticed that they would do an aisatsu in English at the beginning and every level, or at the beginning and end of every lesson in the junior high school class, which was basically analogous to the kinds of aisatsu that I saw in the elementary school classes.
Interesting. All right. So
But
I
that's
kind of
the
wanted
end
to
of that.
talk about this interaction going from the Hapyo to the consensus check and how it's relevant to the universe, how it can be relevant to students being uncomfortable when they get to the university level. So this idea of dyadic, okay, versus something which you call the interactional umbrella. People are interested. You also wrote a chapter with Wolf in 2019 talking about this interactional umbrella. The Japanese perspective is more of the interactional umbrella. The Western perspective is more of the dyadic relationship. Now, can you talk about the concepts of dyadic versus interactional umbrella?
So, whereas in a typical Western classroom in discourse pattern, you find teacher and the students are, I mean, you have the teacher and then you have the students as a block. But normally, when the teacher asks a question, it's expected that one student will answer it, and then the teacher will comment on that student's answer. Or if she or he does not like the answer, then say, well, can anybody else answer this? So you tend to have a back and forth between the teacher and individual students in one after the other in sequence. But like I say, what I saw was that students were actually explicitly taught to react to each other and to listen to each other. And so one student says something, and other students will, in chorus, might say, "Ides." Okay, that's okay. Or onaji desu. Okay, we have the same thing. And then the teacher's evaluation at the end would be more an evaluation of the interaction that happened between students than of any particular individual student's answer.
Right. So this is the interesting concept for me because even in chapter 5 of this handbook, where they're talking about tearing down the wall of silence, I actually interviewed John Wiltshire on episode 20 or something. And what he was talking about is, Western teachers were taught like the speed of or as a students were kind of taught the speed of the response is most important. So the teacher, we're starting off a topic, we're activating knowledge, we're eliciting information. The accuracy is not so important. We're just trying to like get some response, right? And so when when people that come to teach in Japan, they're kind of shocked with the silence because they'll throw out a topic. Normally, they're going to get some feedback in a Western context. They're not going to get it in Japan. And you traced it back. And what you were saying is like, it doesn't flow between the student and the teacher dyadically, if that's a word. It's more, it flows from the teacher to an individual, kind of to a consensus check, and then building up, right? And then you can connect this to like Japanese society, like as far as like companies, like can it's more bottom. I think Meyer in 2000, her book, The Culture Map, she talked about bottom up hierarchical decision making. So like decisions can happen very slowly in a company because it starts off, maybe someone throws out an idea at an izakaya, and then you have to build sort of consensus, and then there's like stamping going on, then it'll go to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. And by the time it gets to the CEO, he understands everyone sort of stamped it. He or she has stamped everything on the way up, right? So this idea of like building consensus decision making through the group is really this important concept in Japanese society.
And I think that's one of the, that's certainly one of the places where it comes from. Yeah, I'm not familiar with Meyer, but that does sound interesting and very relevant.
The thing that I thought was very interesting about this idea between dyadic and the interactional umbrella is I did research into language learning anxiety. And one of the things that kind of kept coming up is that, okay, there are going to be students that are going to be a little bit nervous when it comes to these Western finger quote concepts of communicative language teaching, where we place students into groups and we're having them stand up and move around and all these like different interactionals. Now, it could just be like a thing where students are uncomfortable standing up and moving around and like meeting new people. That could be one thing, right? But I kind of was thinking this idea of the interactional umbrella, if teachers can leverage it to use it for the communicative language teaching, which we kind of already are, right? We're putting groups into pair, have a pair check, right? Japanese students aren't comfortable giving the answer without making a consensus check. So I thought it was kind of, it was nice to read this perspective where, like, look, we're not so far off. Like, maybe that students are uncomfortable, like I said, in different ways. Like, if we say, okay, find a partner, yeah, maybe they'll be uncomfortable with that. Like, maybe we should like choose their partner. But as far as like getting together with like groups, I think they are comfortable with that, right? So I'm just kind of wondering, like, what where do you think the disconnect? You've probably heard the same arguments, right? Like CLT methodology can cause anxiety with students, but it doesn't have to be, right?
No, I think you're right on the point there. I think it's partially is not building enough structure into the activity or into the way that the groups are going to be formed or the roles of the different members of the groups, for example. But I find that, group work works fine if it's structured according to a way that's, comfortable for the students.
And you talk about it in the chapter as far as students will, you even talked about it in the 1993 chapter, but and that's 20 years before Jim King did his like that seminal work about classroom silence, right? How students will very rarely like raise topics or instigate conversations or challenge the teacher, all of these things that you were well aware of, in 1993. And you talked about how like students will more likely, if they have a question, they're not going to ask during class. They'll sometimes wait till after class,
That's right.
which can be very frustrating for a teacher, right? Because you're like, well, this was a great question and I could have used this, right? I could have taught everyone this, right? At the same time. Now I've noticed that, right? I've kind of gotten used to that. And I think a lot of the you're talking about in the book, it's better to like one of the strategies, you give a few strategies on how to deal with this. One of them is to try to explicitly tell people what's going on, like what are the expectations, right? And I think over time students can adapt to that. I did an autoethnographic case study on myself, obviously, where I was like just observing times where I was having an emotional reaction to silence. And I'm going to extend this study this year with a few other teachers. They're also going to sort of make notes when they have these emotional reactions to silence. One of them was I had set up like the tasks for students to do. And once they finish this, they do that. Once they finish this, they do that. And they're kind of doing it individually. They have to interact with the e-learning, they have to do certain things. They're not really working in a group, but if they need to ask someone a question, they can, right? But this was close to the near the term, right? So most people seemed to be knowing what was going on and working fine. But this one student looked really, really confused, right? And he was like looking back to his the person behind him, and he was like asking him these questions, right? And I walked up to him and I said, do you need any help? And he just like stared at me, like said nothing, like zero, like no response at all. And then I said in Japanese, do you need some help? And like no response. And I kind of just like did the Homer Simpson where I backed up through the bush. I was like, okay. And then went right back to asking the guy like behind him. And what my theory on that was, they don't want to be, they don't want to have that dyadic communication, even if it wasn't this situation where I'm standing in front of the class. Like I didn't know it then, but after kind of reading the chapter, that kind of like crystallized to me, like even in that situation, right? They would prefer to it flow through a group, even though he individually doesn't understand. He didn't want to have this one-to-one conversation with me, at least in front of his classmates.
Yeah, it was
Even when it
very.
was a situation where the classmate might not know what's going on, I know. I'm the teacher, right? I can help you. So that was definitely a frustrating moment for me. Now I've kind of thought about ways to try to avoid that. But it is that dyadic, that concept of dyadic is it's very interesting.
Yeah, well, students, I mean, they will, and they most of them, or a lot of them anyway, do want to interact with a teacher, but not in. The more formalized setting of the classroom, where, they might be seen negatively by their peers if they stand out too much.
Yeah, so let's go into some of the strategies that you talk about for people that struggle with this. So that consensus check you talk about in the chapter, it can be annoying for teachers. And that was brought up in chapter 5 as well, where the idea where a teacher will ask a question to an individual student, there will be a big pause, then they might even take time to talk to their neighbor to do the consensus check. And like there's these long pauses, right? And it can be kind of frustrating, right? One of the solution for that, you kind of talk about, split them into groups, like you talked about before, making sure everyone has like a specific job. Then when it's time to do like a consensus check, there's a group spokesman. They don't feel as isolated or exposed. So that was one thing. Another one of the recommendations you said was the idea of just, lecturing. Like students are comfortable with lecturing. Now, a lot of teachers coming up through teacher training were taught, like, lower your teacher talk time, lower your teacher talk time. But sometimes it's okay to do lecturing. And you had another advice. Oh yeah, so the group, as far as like really nailing down the roles for each student, right? You're the secretary, right? You're the spokesman. Were there any other? I think those are the top three that came out. Were there more?
I think I said one of them, I believe, was kind of blending in, trying to
Oh, right. Yeah.
make use of the classroom dynamics that they're used to, throughout the whole socialization process.
Now, okay, I'm glad you brought that out. So you were, and that's what kind of made me think about the idea of, so in elementary school, there's these class meetings. Now it might not be where, yeah, maybe you're just talking about the topic. Maybe you didn't observe it in the first grade level.
I observed it a little bit, but it wasn't the main focus of what I was.
I have noticed sometimes it is better to kind of leave the classroom when you set them to a task, then come back to do the consensus check with the groups, right? I think that is an interesting idea, right? Sometimes they're more comfortable with the teachers not kind of hovering over their shoulder so much, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a take on that?
Yeah, basically, I agree with that. But I mean, my approach, if they were doing group work in the class and doing some kind of extended discussion or project, or preparing a group presentation, I would try to get around to each of the groups and just kind of make myself available, but without, really hovering over any one group too much.
I find that's a tough balance, right?
Right.
Because sometimes you walk over some groups, they really like that, right? And then some groups, they kind of just freeze up.
Yeah. So,
And
I
you're
mean, I think how you present yourself is important. I mean, I would maybe either stand close to the group where they know that I'm there, or sit down, but not sit down like I'm a member of the group. Sit down a little bit away so that I'm available, but not trying to interfere.
A couple more topics from the chapter. One of them was like the theory. So in the 1993 chapter, you talk about how the Hapyo is related, or sociologists have talked about how that is sort of related to social conditioning, right? So I'll just read from the chapter. So you were quoting educational anthropologist Mary White, observes that while to a Westerner this emphasis on public performance from early in the children's school life may appear to be an encouragement of independent thought, the fact that it is ritualized and predictable removes the children from responsibility from their own pronouncements. While the young pupils may later go on to recite their own work, White notes that a personal response is not offered until after they have acquired confidence in their skill as performers. In contrast to the West, ritualized performance in Japan appears to be a prerequisite to personal expression. And now that really kind of blew my mind. When I read that, I kind of needed to take a second and think about that, right? Because as a casual observer of the classroom, it did kind of feel that, they're standing up, they're giving their opinion, right? But from reading that paragraph, you kind of look at it in a different way. Well, there's this sort of ritualized process where they're going to say this and it's going to be followed by this, and then you're building up the confidence to say it. That kind of blew my mind, right? So, what do you have any th thoughts on that? Yeah, because that was written in 1993, that paragraph where you were talking about Mary White.
So I think the first part of what you said was quoted from Mary White, right? And then the last part was my own interpretation, I believe. So Mary White is, I don't know if she's continued to work on this, but she had a book called The Japanese Educational Challenge. I think that was the name of it. It was very well known about that time. And it was not specifically or, even mainly about language learning and teaching or language use. It was more an overview of Japanese education in general. So that was but that was an observation of hers that really dovetailed a lot with things that I was observing in the classroom, that especially at the lower levels, which is what I focused on first and second grade, a lot of the hapyo would be things that students had written down in advance in their textbooks in advance, in response to questions. And then the teacher would throw out the question, and students would look at what they had written and make a presentation hapyo about that. And that would, generate the answers or the responses, the reactions from the other students. And so, from what I saw, I mean, a lot of the expression, students' individual expression, moved in that direction from the ritualized to maybe later on, to the more spontaneous.
Really, really interesting. All right, another thing, something that was kind of a cool thing that you added in the 2019 chapter is you added this anecdote that kind of bookended the 2019 chapter that you received sort of like hate mail from the 1993 chapter. You said it was like scribbled on a postcard. You kind of made the joke that nowadays it would be like a tweet, maybe. One of the only angry hate mails you've ever received. Can you talk about the topic of what the hate mail or what that postcard was about?
Yeah, that was interesting. It was maybe I got that about a year after the book and the chapter had come out. And I know several people who had read the chapter and really liked it and, complimented me on it. People in I would say high academic positions who I respected. And then I get this hate mail out of the blue, or this postcard, whatever you want to call it, kind of accusing me of being the reason why more Japanese students don't learn English, because I'm being too, well, I think ass kissing is the word that this person used. I didn't keep the postcard, but
You didn't have it framed, put on the wall.
no, I was thinking of it, but then I was kind of bothered by it, so I said, no, nah, I don't want to keep this. But then it never really left my mind, and so I incorporated it in with the later article, the later chapter. But I mean, from what I remember about it, I mean, the main complaint was the idea of my suggesting that Westerners should be accommodating, or I said they should be accommodating to local styles of interaction, and this person seemed to think that, on the contrary, we should be teaching our cultural values and our styles of interaction as a part of the language that we're teaching, as a part of the package.
Okay, so this is a really interesting topic, I think. So you talk about in the chapter the teachers that don't last long in society, don't last long teaching in this educational culture in Japan, are actually doing what the guy, woman, the post who wrote that postcard. Those are the people that end up getting burned out. Because you're trying to teach this Western way that is just not going to work if they've been, socially sort of trained from this young age up until that point. So then that begs the question, right? And again, this was another topic in the chapter. So there's the argument you can't separate language from culture, right? So you could say, well, if you're studying French, then you'd have to know about like French culture, right? If you have a French teacher from France, you can't separate French from, I don't know, right? And then the counter argument with English is you cannot attach any one culture to English as an international language. So then that kind of got me thinking, well, really is what is the purpose of the language teacher? Now, you could trace this argument to like the JET program, right? So what was the purpose of the JET program? Was it to increase the English level? Ostensibly, I guess it was. Or was it a way to sort of get Japanese people less anxious to be around foreigners? So then the question is the job of the English language teacher to teach English skills, or is it the job of the English language teacher to get the students more comfortable around the cultural communication style? Because the cultural communication style of an American who uses English is different than how maybe someone from the Philippines uses English, is different from someone how, Germany uses English. So it's like that. I think that's what some teachers struggle with. Like, really, what am I doing here, right? Because if you're going to take your advice too strong one way, right? So I need to accommodate the students. I need to become more Japanese in my socialization to make this work, where there isn't as much tension and much stress. If you take it your way, then you could have the identity, well, maybe I'm not doing enough to prepare them for when they're going to meet an American, right? Then if you take it the other way, then you're just going to be in like constant stress all the time, right? So I think that's like a kind of an existential crisis for some teachers. And I don't know how they end up figuring it out. But I love a topic like that where like initially, like immediately I'm like was debating it, right? 'Cause like, oh, I've had thoughts going both ways. And someday, I guess, I don't know if I'm just talking out the answer myself. I'm not doing a good job because you're the guest. You should give your answer. But I guess it's somewhere in the middle, right?
Well, that's what I argued. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the middle, and I think it's certainly true that I mean, more and more it's true that Japanese need English, if they need it at all. They needed to communicate internationally, not just with Americans or with Brits or Australians or whoever. And every country has its own interactional styles, which to some extent would be transferred to English. And so just by learning an American style of interaction, this does not assure that students will be able to communicate successfully with somebody from the Philippines or India or France or Germany or wherever. And a lot of my thinking in this line comes from the field which is called World Englishes, or a spin-off, English as a lingua franca, which I was first exposed to in the 1980s with Larry Smith in Hawaii, who used to say that, okay, if English is an international language, it's not just learners, it's not just the non-native speakers who have to learn to communicate with the native speakers in the native speaker way. The native speakers as well have to learn English as an international language because they, don't know that, the people that they're communicating with will be able to successfully interpret what they're saying.
Yeah, this
The American way or British way, which again, could be different from the American way.
yeah, this is a chapter. So I had read through the 2019 chapter a few times, took notes, thought about it. I've been sort of trying to coordinate it into my literature review to fit my aims. Then I read the 1993 chapter, and then today I reread through the 2019 chapter. So it's two parts. Like, I think it's an easy read, finger quotes, for people to digest the core concepts. But I think it's also a read. It's one of those you can read a few times, and maybe you should read a few times, depending on your like research interests or what or the reason you'd want to read that.
You're talking about 2019? Okay, yeah. 2019, 93 was simpler, I think, in its structure. It was fairly.
Yeah, it was more of like a faster read, I think. But yeah, man, this was a really great work. It's funny. I feel like the longer I'm in this field as like a researcher, it just doesn't really get easier to me as far as writing. And so when I read someone's writing who's like coherent and you can just tell they put a lot of thought into it, and I'm just really impressed because I don't know about other people. For me, writing is still very, very hard. And to put these thoughts together, hats off. It's like a thrill to actually talk to the author. So.
Well, actually, writing has become more difficult for me over the years. And
Interesting.
because I worry more about, a lot of things that I'm writing about and the way I'm putting ideas together. And, a few decades ago, when I was actually in graduate school and then working on my dissertation, I could write a lot more, a lot faster. But as a result, I don't publish that much, but I try to do some good things.
Well, it was a good thing coming on this podcast. I hope people enjoyed today's episode. You might not hear from me for another 6 months or so. So, thank you, Fred. Thanks for bringing me back. It's nice for me to be back. I haven't been back in a while.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
If you'd like to contact the show, the best place to find out about us is our website, lostincitations.com. Here you can learn more about the background to this project and how you can get involved. Our hope is to help academics, educators, and online content producers get in contact with each other. Our email address is lostincitations@gmail.com. We also have Facebook and LinkedIn pages. Please rate and comment on the sites you use to download your podcasts. It helps us reach more potential listeners. But probably the most helpful thing you can do is, if you like our content, recommend it to a friend and let them know what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.